Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org. Okay, and so when I was on a mission in Guatemala, we showed a little film strip. And the little film strip was, I think it was called Ancient America Speaks. I'm not sure. But I think, have you seen this film strip?
Ancient America's what?
Ancient America Speaks, I think it was called, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know.
But here was the basic premise. It was that, you know, Jesus lived in the old world, and he, you know, visited people there. But he also said in the Bible, other sheep I have that are not of this fold, you know, them too shall hear my word. And then it said, did you know that Jesus, after he died, came and visited the Americas? And he came to America. There's a big earthquake. He came to America, sat down, called 12 apostles, formed a church. And this is what the Book of Mormon claims. And the people prior to Jesus were already believing that Jesus was going to come. They were baptizing in his name. They were, setting up temples and, or doing rituals that were kind of Jewish or pre or Christian rituals. But that Jesus came, called 12 apostles, started his church, and there's evidence of that in the New World because, you know, there's this legend of a great white god, maybe his name was Quetzalcoatl, who came and visited. There was a light, you know, there are hieroglyphs about a light-skinned people and a dark-skinned people. And, you know, there are excavations of temples that had baptismal fonts, which is likely where people performed these Christian baptisms. And, you know, there's even hieroglyphs about the tree of life, about a big tree that very much maps what Lehi's dream and what he would have told in the Book of Mormon. So this is a film strip that I showed, you know, probably 1,000 people on my mission, basically saying that New World, you know, this was published by the church. This was given to missionaries to teach people. And it basically said, hey, you people in Latin America, did you know that you are the descendants of these Lamanite people, that the light-skinned people were killed off and the dark-skinned people lived, and they're the pure blood of Israel, and you're awesome because you are these people, and you're the chosen blood. You know, that was kind of what I remember. I could have some of the details wrong.
That's a big order here. You know, I first came into contact with this when I first got married. I took Sophie, my wife. I said, you've got to, this is Christmas vacation, let's go down to Yucatan and whatnot. You've never seen Maya sites. I mean, you know, she married to a Maya archaeologist. She was an anthropologist, but a social anthropologist. I said, let's go on down and see some of the main Maya sites in Yucatan and get down to Palenque and Chiapas in southeastern Mexico, and I'll take you through these. So we did, and we spent 2 or 3 weeks down there. We saw everything. I mean, I went back to Chichen Itza and places like that, got to Palenque. And when we were sitting in an outdoor restaurant cafeteria in Mérida, the capital of Yucatan, saw this obvious American with a young guy who seemed to be, you know, his assistant there, a Maya kid, teenager there. And he was listening to us talking. He came across and he said, are you folks Americans? Hey, yeah, we are, and whatnot. And he said, well, why are you down here? I said, well, I'm really an archaeologist, and I'm, you know, looking to get my PhD in archaeology. He said, well, I'll tell you something. He said, did you know that Jesus had a second coming to this part of the world? I said, well, I've heard that some people believe this. And he said, yes, he came to Palenque down in southeastern Chiapas and actually preached from the Temple of the Cross at Palenque. Well, we were headed to Palenque. I'd never been there. And then he gave me his card, and it had a name on it, and it said, Council of the 12 Apostles, but not from Salt Lake City, from Independence, Missouri.
Ah,
he was a Reorganite.
Gotcha.
And this is the first time I'd ever heard of the Reorganite. Very nice guy. So that I heard about that a long, long time ago, over 50 years ago. Let's just talk about Palenque, the Temple of the Cross at Palenque. There are three temples together in one part of this great, beautiful, well-understood site of Palenque. We can huge amounts of inscriptions that we can read everything on them now. The Temple of the Cross, there is something that looks like a cross, a great slab in the back. It's all got a huge bas-relief on it with two individuals facing each other on either side of this thing. And there's a bird on the top sitting there. We now know that this is basically a world direction tree. It's a stylized tree that it's sprouting vegetation and whatnot on all sides. That the two individuals are not Jesus down below or somebody else and a disciple, but rather that this is a great Maya king whose name we know. His name is Kanbalam, which means snake jaguar. And he's shown as a kid and as a mature individual who's taken office. It's two parts. It's really his life story. And that Kanbalam built all of these other temples around it are his work. There's no mention of Jesus or apostles or anything that's Christian or Hebrew in that inscription. It's a very long one. And as I say, we can now read it in its totality. There's no more mystery about it whatsoever. It's got to do with a Maya creation, with a whole Maya idea of this particular dynasty at Palenque, about their divine origins, how they descended from the gods and so forth. It's got nothing whatsoever to do with the Bible or with Jesus. So that one, which is often used, is simply invalid. I think that's, you know, what the other things that were in your film strip, again, when you really analyze them, they all turn out to be things that are either misunderstood or else they're Native American period that have nothing to do with the Middle East.
Okay.
Now, I'd like to say one thing now is that about this whole idea of contact between the old world and the new world. I'm not entirely against the idea of oceanic contacts. In fact, there's beginning to be evidence for it. The leading scholar of this kind of stuff is a Mormon, mm-hmm. a friend of mine, John Sorensen, at BYU, who's written extensively on this whole thing. Very interesting stuff. I mean, he's a real scholar. I think that he's, again, often looking in the wrong direction. But I think there's pretty good evidence for contact between East Asia and Southeast Asia, not the Middle East at all, but totally in another direction, across the Pacific. Recently, not so long ago, very recently, within this past year, they have done analysis of bones found on the coast of Chile, northern Chile, in what was the Inca Empire. Within the Inca Empire, but right on the coast of a culture, of a community that could be dated about 1100, 1200, 1300 AD, you know, hundreds of years before the Spaniards got there. There are chicken bones in this. We've got the radiocarbon dates now on it. They have analyzed the DNA in the chicken bones, and they turn out not to be Middle Eastern chickens at all, I'm sorry, but rather Polynesian chickens. Hmm. The Polynesians, who are an old world people, they moved out into the Pacific, had been in contact with the New World, I think, for a very long period of time. Hmm. Wonderful, wonderful. Certainly from, say, 1200 AD on, they had the means to get to America and go back. They brought the sweet potato, which is a totally American plant, back across the Pacific to the old world, long before the Spaniards got to the New World, with the name the native name of the sweet potato.
Man, I would like to meet those Polynesians who made that boat trip.
Those people were really good. I mean, listen, they reached Easter Island, which is the farthest point of anything from anywhere else on Earth. I mean, it's the most distant place on Earth. They got there, you know, and these are the people who set up all the big heads on Easter Island. The Polynesians and the Micronesians also were the most incredible navigators. Really incredible.
Wow. Okay.
I'm not against this kind of study.
Sure.
And John Sorensen has really come up with some interesting stuff. But to me, it all points to the eastern part of the old world, of eastern Eurasia. That is China and Southeast Asia in particular.
Gotcha. And just this idea of, is there any evidence that a Christ figure came that, you know, the light-skinned, dark-skinned, that any of the narrative in the Book of Mormon, the reign of judges, just, you know, all that stuff, any evidence of that? Christian teachings, Christian remnants in, you know, Mesoamerican religious ritual?
Well, let's say that Mesoamerican religious rituals and religious beliefs and whatnot were really complex, highly complex with a when the Spaniards came, the Catholic priests came, the first friars arrived, they were kind of amazed to see that they had confession to the gods. They had a mother goddess. They had, which is not, again, something out of Jewish ideas at all.
Right.
They had all sorts of things which made it easy for them to convert these people, to get them to recognize Jesus. The question about Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, the culture hero.
Right. The great white god, right?
This comes up over and over and over again. And you have to go to the original sources about Quetzalcoatl. The Spaniards, I think, had every reason to want to make this guy into a white man, because they weren't thinking about Jesus coming, you know, second coming to the new world arriving, but rather Cortez, the white conquistador. They wanted a story that was, they could identify a native prophecy that would justify and kind of clinch the idea that Cortez was a god.
Oh.
They're not thinking about Jesus at all. They're thinking about Cortez as their returned god.
So the Indians would accept the conquest more.
The Indians would accept the conquest.
Gotcha.
There's now a big literature, a study about this thing. You have to take what the Spaniards said. They built this thing up big to justify the horrible things that they did to the Indians.
Mm.
But this whole idea of a white people coming to the New World is basically made out of whole cloth. It was propaganda, first set up by the Spaniards, then picked up by European racists who didn't want to accept the idea that dark-skinned people could have built temples and huge mounds in the middle part of this country, or anything, or the Inca. So it all had to be somebody from elsewhere with white skin.
So there is a dark and a light skin narrative outside of Mormonism that tries to explain or interpret.
First by the Spaniards. And I think to justify their conquest, what I consider, I would rather call the invasion, the European invasion of the New World. Yes. And it was picked up by people in 19th century America very quickly, this whole idea that there must have been another race that built those mounds, because these miserable Indians that we look at, they couldn't have possibly have done something like that.
Okay. And so those who would say, yes, Jesus came, yes, he descended in a pillar of light, yes, he taught Christianity and started a church, and, you know, yes, all this happened, but because the dark-skinned people killed all the light-skinned people, and they were savage, you know, kind of ignorant savages, their culture devolved to the point where their language deteriorated, their legends and stories deteriorated, their knowledge of coinage and of metallurgy and everything else deteriorated. And not only do we not find any artifacts, but we don't even find any written or cultural remnants of Christianity. You know, that argument of saying, of course we don't find any of this because they denigrated into savagery. How do you find that type of
That's question? One more racist story. Absolutely without any merit whatsoever. Look at what the American Indians, these degraded Lamanites, these dark-skinned people, gave to the rest of the world. You know, after the conquest, after contact had been made between the conquistadores, let's say, and the Portuguese and others, with these people, look what they gave to the rest of the world. Okay. The list of domestic plants is enormously long.
What does that mean? That means that they had to work and use their intellect.
Those were all domesticated by them. They're all carefully selected. I mean, domestication is evolution under the control of man.
Right.
And these, over thousands of years, they domesticated these wild plants. What we eat would be unheard of before they were discovered, so-called, by Columbus and whatnot. What were Europeans eating? Mush, mainly. Mm. I mean, tasteless mush. These people, I mean, corn, for instance, maize, which is a giant grass. Wild maize, you would never look at it twice. It's so small and miserable looking. It's called teosinte. You wouldn't even think about it. They took that and domesticated it over thousands of years. They took all of the squashes that we eat, the tomatoes, the peppers, just a host, manioc or cassava or tapioca, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. There's a list that's enormously long, not even mentioning the pharmaceutical plants that they had. They were incredible people. The Spaniards, these wonderful white-skinned Spaniards that everybody says are the superior conquistadores and whatnot because how wonderful they were. How many plants were ever domesticated by the Spaniards? Zero. How many plants were ever domesticated by the Italians, who really were civilized? Zero. Mm. How many plants were ever domesticated in Europe? Zero. Mm. The Middle East domesticated them. These are the plants that are in the Book of Mormon, but they're basically a tiny list compared to the list that New World Indians, these degraded Lamanites, did.
Maybe they got their domestication from the Middle East.
No, they didn't. It goes back. Plants were starting to be domesticated in the New World, according to radiocarbonate, at the same time that they were being domesticated in the Middle East and in China. The dates are the same. They started doing this way back then, very close to once the Ice Age was over. It didn't take them long to do this. Mm-hmm. And maize, for instance, is probably the most productive plant in the world. Today, it now runs our automobiles. There's nothing like it. That never came out of the Middle East. Hmm. These people were incredibly civilized, even if they didn't have temples like the Maya or the Incas and their ancestors. They were hard at work on the natural world, molding it for human needs.
Wait, who didn't have temples?
Well, a lot of the Indians of the New World who lived more marginal areas, like Southern South America, didn't have temples. And in the far north of North America, no.
Okay.
The Pueblo peoples of the Southwest had them, and they had mighty apartment houses. The big temple people were in Mesoamerica and in the Andes.
Okay. And do you find their technologies other than agriculture, their language, their technologies, their civilizations, their cultures, to be highly evolved for their time or devolved or, you know?
The Andes, metallurgy was highly evolved from really very, very, very early. Mm-hmm. I mean, going back to, 1000 BC and earlier, they started to experiment with technology and casting metals and doing things like that. Never iron. Mm-hmm. Or steel, mm-hmm. never. Mm-hmm. But
what were they What metals were these?
Copper, gold, bronze.
Okay. Okay.
Bronze alloys. Okay. Very sophisticated technologies, which they later brought to Mesoamerica after from 700 or 800 AD on.
Okay. So the general idea that at one point these were civilized people, but then they devolved into savages, doesn't resonate with you.
It does not resonate with professional archaeologists
okay.
at all.
Okay.
And I'm amazed that it would resonate with the Native Americans themselves in any way, because they're being depreciated.
Right. And that's, to be honest, that's kind of bugged me a little bit. If the narrative is that the bad darkies killed off the good whiteies and became savages, and by the way, you're a descendant of these people, like, maybe they have ancestors they might be more proud of and gain confidence by instead of shame, you know, from. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And it's had political repercussions, too. I mean, I don't want to really get into this, but Guatemala, as you know, went through this terrible period of civil wars and outright genocide on the part of the Guatemalan military and Guatemalan government,
right.
where hundreds of thousands of these dark-skinned Maya were slaughtered at the behest of a white government and white army officers. And I think some of that racism has spilled over to them. There's still people in Guatemala who think that way.
Yeah.
When I came to Yucatan early on, first in Merida, again in a restaurant. Remember this old Yucatecan, completely white, descended, you know, of the conquistadores, you can be sure, with a little Maya shoeshine boy shining his shoes. And he points to him and he says, "Do you consider this guy human?" I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Well, you know, people say that this guy and all of those other Indians built Chichen Itza. Do you really believe that?" You know, I said, "Why not?"
Right.
You know, and he, you know, he was saying this in Spanish, so this poor little guy was understanding what he was talking about. Hmm. That's the mindset that really I object to, and that's in this idea of, you know, the Lamanites as the dark-skinned savages.
Gotcha. Okay. Is it possible? Well, I'll get to what Joseph Smith might have been thinking at the time. Real quick, DNA. What's your understanding of the DNA? I know you're not a geneticist, but
I'm not a geneticist. My father-in-law was a very distinguished one, Theodosius Dobzhansky. He was one of I married the daughter of one of the great geneticists.
Oh, wow.
But he died some time ago. But I would submit this question to him. I know they use a lot of the DNA stuff, but as far as I've never seen anything there that would convince me that these people have Middle Eastern DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Let's put it that way.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, so and then the Book of Mormon mentions hundreds of thousands of people. Sometimes, if I recall correctly, battles where hundreds of thousands of people kind of fought each other, again, with swords and shields and whatever, if I'm recalling correctly.
You are.
Is that type of population possible?
Yes, that's true. I mean, whether this you'd have hundreds of thousands of sides in an army, in one army, the Aztecs could field fairly good-sized armies, but never that size. The Maya area, which is the one in question, if we're going to talk about, you know, what happened to the Nephites, the Maya area, there was never an empire. People used to think there was an old empire, a new empire. You know, archaeologists like the great Sylvanus Morley back 75 years ago, he was big on an old empire that then collapsed, and then there was a new empire up in northern Yucatan. There was never any overall political empire in the Maya area. They were quite small city states, but there was big populations. I mean, there were a lot of Maya. Nobody can really estimate how many Maya there were, because we don't have any census figures for us at all. But you can estimate it you know, what could have been the productivity of this kind of maize corn agriculture, given this kind of land, etc., and come up with some guesses. And it would have been many millions. There's no doubt about it. At the height of the classic Maya, let's say at about 500 to 700 AD, there would have been probably several million people in the Maya area. But the way they fought, there were never probably any big armies fielded, you know, permanent armies. The Aztecs had them later on, but they never amounted to that many people. So
and no swords and shields and helmets and chariots.
That way. And certainly not with swords and shields. You'd find evidence for that. There's
big mounds of bones and shields and helmets.
Right? Yeah, you'd find big mounds of bones. What you do find, there's limited evidence for this. Well, I'd like to backtrack and say, it's very hard to find evidences for battles, even well-known ones, except in modern times where you have so much hardware out there. But, for instance, the Battle of Hastings, 1066 in England, that's changed the entire course of English history. The Normans defeated the Anglo-Saxons there, the English. You think that that battlefield would be very easy to identify archaeologically, even if you didn't know from the records what happened in 1066. Hardly any evidence whatsoever archaeologically for the Battle of Hastings. It's very hard to pick up battlefield evidence. Nevertheless, there are limited, in the Maya area, there have been found limited evidence for mass battle or for defeat of a particular city. Mm-hmm. And one of them is a site called Ahuateca in Guatemala up on the Petén-Batún region, where you have almost a Pompeii-like situation where everybody had to leave, including the royalty and the scribes and the whole works, pick up and leave everything there. That's been dug by a very good University of Arizona archaeologist, Takeshi Inomata. There is at the site of Yaxchilan along the river that divides Mexico and Guatemala, the Usumacinta, one of the mounds there that really the result of a temple collapsing is covered with stone arrow points, not steel ones.
Okay.
Expect. And then Richard Hansen, who is a Mormon archaeologist, but likes to say he's an archaeologist who happens to be a Mormon, who's digging the great early site of El Mirador in northernmost Guatemala, the greatest probably of all Maya sites. He's got evidence for, again, such a battle, but these are stone points, you know, obsidian and things like that. No steel, no metal whatsoever.
Okay. Yeah, I forgot to mention, this is just jumping back, but I forgot to mention, any Reformed Egyptian remnants in the languages or linguistics of, I mean, we don't even know what that is, but I mean, any remnants of Egyptian hieroglyphs in Mayan or?
Well, let's say this way. No, there's no Egyptian hieroglyphs have ever really shown up. There are some roller seals, clay roller seals, that showed up in one of the New World Archaeology Foundation sites called Chapa de Corso, and it was claimed early on by Thomas Stewart Ferguson, who I might say a few things about, that there were Egyptian hieroglyphs on that, but nobody really believes that anymore. What is Reformed Egyptian? I mean, you know about the Book of Abraham, which is really an extremely important Mormon text in the Mormon religion,
right,
which Smith claimed was, Smith said he translated this from an Egyptian manuscript, which was sold to him. It actually was. I've forgotten what the date was, but it was something like 1835. And he immediately saw that it was Egyptian, but he claimed it was in Reformed Egyptian and that he could read it. And he did. He provided this translation, which is the Book of Abraham, supposed to be Abraham's sojourn in Egypt in captivity when he worked for the pharaohs, and what happened to him and his relatives and all the rest of it. And this is a well-known Mormon text. It's part of the, I think, what, the Pearl of Great Price.
Mm-hmm.
This manuscript disappeared after a while, and it showed up in fragments in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I don't know how long ago, but it was, let's say, within several decades ago. And they have extremely good Egyptologists there who immediately recognize it as an Egyptian Book of the Dead, a fragment of it. That's the most common Egyptian. It's a funerary text.
Mm-hmm.
Deals only with Egyptian gods, you know, Isis, Osiris, all the rest of them, Thoth, the god of writing, etc. It has to do with the journey of the soul, the Egyptian soul, to the land of the dead and what he or she is going to inquire. It's a very common text. There are dozens and dozens of books of the dead. Smith had absolutely no knowledge of Egyptian hieroglyphs. He had no ability whatsoever to translate any Egyptian hieroglyphs, whether he called them Reformed Egyptian or not. Now, let's get to Thomas Stewart Ferguson. You mentioned that idea of one fold and one shepherd.
Yes.
Tom Ferguson was a lawyer from Orinda, California, and a former FBI guy. Worked for the FBI for quite a while. A really, really nice guy. I knew him. He's a wonderful person with a wonderful family. And, of course, a believing iron rod Mormon, I think.
Right.
An old-time Mormon. And he was desperate to get archaeologists interested in finding evidence, archaeological evidence, digging, to identify Zarahemla and to dig there and to find evidence for it. And so he was one of the founders, along with Milton Hunter and others, and I think Mr. Marriott, of the New World Archaeological Foundation, which is still in existence. And he and others persuaded the church to put in a huge amount of money into this project. They did the right thing from the beginning. They got some of, not only, you know, Book of Mormon archaeologists and enthusiasts onto this, but they got renowned American archaeologists, Americanist archaeologists, scientific ones on it, like A.V. Kidder, Alfred Kidder, who I knew very well, who I think was a great archaeologist of his day, anywhere. This was going to be set up not as specifically as Book of Mormon archaeology, but to dig in the most likely place in the right time, according to the Book of Mormon, to find, you know, evidence for the Jaredites and the Nephites.
Right.
And this was identified by Book of Mormon geographers as a location in southeastern Chiapas, specifically the coast and then inland at a site called Chapa de Corso. And they dug there for years and years. I visited them early on, really under orders from A.V. Kidder to find out if this was a legitimate excavation. I came back singing high praises for these people who were doing this job. Really amazing guys like the late Gareth Lowe, who knew more about this pre-classic formative period in Mesoamerica as anybody else I ever knew. A wonderful human being. Now deceased, but a really terrific guy. And most of the archaeologists, almost all of them who've been working there, are first class. It's now run by, really in the hands of John Clark, who I consider one of the great Mesoamericanists of today. They really never found plates of gold or wheels or steel swords or anything of the sort. They've got a wonderful evolution of stuff from really the very ancient villages going back to, let's say, almost 1800 to 2000 BC, all the way on through the whole story of pre-Columbian Native Americans in that area. And they're nothing else but Native American cultures, one after another. Magnificent piece of work. So constantly arriving there in early days were kind of slight screwballs out of Salt Lake and places like that, coming down with metal detectors who they tried to shoo off the site, running around trying to find plates of gold and whatnot with metal detectors. But It was a completely legitimate operation. They published everything that they've ever found beautifully. Wonderful reports. I rely on them very, very much. I've worked very, very closely with these guys. I'd say, okay, if they're Mormons, they're Mormons who are scientific archaeologists, not Mormon archaeologists.
Gotcha, gotcha. Okay, I want to ask you about these archaeologists, but before we close kind of the more detailed section, what about Book of Mormon geography? Is there any geography that you think find is credible or reasonable that could map or tie to Book of Mormon geography?
Well, there's been this huge amount of literature on this, and I relied on a good friend at Princeton who was raised as a Mormon to help me in this. And when I did that article for Dialogue, I had to go into all of that, and I've forgotten a lot of it. I do know that there's considerable disagreement between Salt Lake City Mormons and Independence, Missouri Mormons about Book of Mormon geography, because there are all kinds of stuff, you know, in both traditions. And so it was so long ago that I looked
at it. Okay.
I hate to even open my mouth on this.
That's fine. The general idea traditionally was that the Book of Mormon, I guess we've gone back and forth, but some people kind of view kind of a limited geography where somewhere in Mesoamerica, the Lamanites and Nephites existed as part of a smaller group of these other existing populations. And, you know, when they talk about Zarahemla and when they talk about the Waters of Mormon, you know, it's somewhere in Mesoamerica. And then there's others. But the problem with that is if Mormon or Moroni wrote plates and buried them in a hill Cumorah,
that's right.
Does that mean that Moroni carried these plates all the way up to New York to bury the plates? I mean, could a feasibly a Mesoamerican 300-400 AD walk and carry metal gold plates up to Palmyra, New York, to bury them? Like, any idea of whether that's...
Let's put it this way: it's unlikely, but of course not impossible.
Okay.
Actually, you know, in ancient America, I think there people were moving around a lot. People, I mean, for instance, Central Mexicans, they knew about the Maya area. They traveled there as traders and whatnot. I mean, the Aztecs relied on all kinds of products from the tropical lowlands, such as chocolate, you know, in their culture. We do know that in Illinois and Ohio, in the Hopewell culture, which is about contemporary with the classic Maya, they went all the way to Yellowstone Park to get obsidian. Mm-hmm. That's a long way.
So they could travel a long way.
Oh, yeah. That doesn't bother me.
Okay.
But the idea that there were plates of gold that even exist, there's no gold among the classic Maya period.
I thought there was a ton of gold among the Aztec, right?
But I'm talking about the classic, in the time frame of the Nephites, there's no gold.
Oh, the gold. Aztecs, gold comes
Aztecs
out of the Aztecs.
Had gold, all right, but gold is late in Mesoamerica.
How late?
There's no real provable gold until about 700 A.D.
And that's after.
And just a little bit of it shows up.
And that's after Moroni would have buried the place.
And it's a technology done in a technology that came to them from the northwestern part of South America, Ecuador and Peru, where people had sailing rafts that could get up to those places, and were trading, I think, extensively in pre-Columbian times, all up and down that's on the Pacific coast side. Okay. The idea that somebody could get from the Maya area carrying golden plates up to bury them, I've been to the Hill Cumorah, I know where it is, Palmyra, New York, mm-hmm. I've stood on it. To get up there is about 99.9% unlikely to me.
Gotcha. And there's no record of there ever being metal plates in the New World where things were written on them, or is there?
No. None. So, let's say there are a few hieroglyphs on some of the gold discs that are very, very late. They're probably about 1400 A.D. Mm-hmm. that were fished out of the sacred well at Chichen Itza. No, there are probably about three hieroglyphs on some of that. That's where they went and some guy went diving down there with a Greek sponge diver's costume. The beginning of the 20th century brought all kinds of stuff, which is up at Harvard. And the gold is very, very late. And there are a couple of hieroglyphs. They're round. They're discs. And the stuff that's on them is completely Mesoamerican.
Okay, not like Hebrew.
But I'm not going to say there are no hieroglyphs on gold, because there are one or two examples of that. And they're kind of they're really badly done hieroglyphs. They're very late.
But never like plates in a ring binder that make up a book.
Period. Nothing, period.
Okay. Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Tis better far to drive, do this and joy. Your hearts will swell. Oh, all is well. All is well. Why should we mourn? I think our love is hard. 'Tis not so. Should we die before our journey?